Wonderful that I lived here all the time.
1259.
Congress cut the gap insurance off for me. So, would it hurt if I just said a couple words? John wants me to testify. I'm shy.
No,
I'm very shy. You should know.
You can have every right to
testify. You know Rep. White.
We have room here for the people who are presenting.
I'm very shy.
There's room here for the people who are presenting on the other bill.
I did it because Representative Nose was getting a haircut.
And open the House Committee on Health Care meeting for February 9th and open a public hearing on House Bill 2290. Do you want to talk? Go outside.
Please.
Listen. No, please. Madam Administrator, what do we got?
2290.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2299 specifies the requirement for reimbursement under a vision care plan. It gives the vision care provider cause of action against insurers for violation of the requirement, prohibits a vision care provider from charging higher rates for services or materials that are not covered by the insurance. You should have on OLIS a dash one amendment, which I believe the proponents will be speaking to, and we have our... There's no revenue impact, and we don't have a fiscal statement yet, Mr. Chair.
Could you call first panel, please?
Sure. Nikki Terziev, Dr. Jim Hale, Dr. Pam DeColesta. DeColesta.
Please, for all the witnesses this afternoon, we have a huge agenda, so if you'd all take as much time as you need, but no more.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Nikki Terziev. I'm here on behalf today of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, our day in the Capitol. It's a pleasure to be here and be here with all of these MDs. We're going to talk with you today just a little bit about HB 2299, and I will, at the end of these comments from our practitioners, be happy to address briefly the dash one amendments.
You know, it's possible I said the wrong number when I opened the hearing.
No, you didn't.
Did I get it right?
You did it right. You're on top of it.
I think you said 2290. Actually, I think Mitch said 2290, not 2299.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Jim Hale, and I'm an optometric physician practicing
in Dr. Hale, hold on 1 minute, just in case. I am opening a public hearing on House Bill 2299, and if I open one before on 2290, I'm closing that one. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I'm an optometric physician in private practice in Corvallis and a member of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. I appear before you today to urge the committee members to support House Bill 2299. Currently in Oregon, national insurance companies are engaging in business practices that are harmful to patients seeking vision care across the state. In addition, these damaging business practices threaten small Oregon businesses and their employees. For the purposes of today's testimony, my goal is to summarize this issue. Large national insurance companies are forcing local small businesses to use specific optical laboratories. When insurers dictate which manufacturer we can use, patients are harmed. Forcing local physicians to use the outside insurance company dictated laboratory gives patients fewer choices. It potentially lowers the quality of the eyewear that they're receiving, and it delays the time it takes to receive the eyewear. Many of these dictated labs are out of state. This mandate undermines the quality patient care and exceptional customer service that we deliver to our patients every day. Another detrimental business practice involves large national insurers dictating prices and discounts on materials and services that they do not cover. For example, sunglasses may not be covered by a patient's plan, but we are required by the insurer to give the patient a 20% discount for which we are not reimbursed. Forced discounts are really an imaginary benefit that insurers sell to their customers. It costs them nothing. As small businesses, it manipulates the economics in our practices. To stay in business, practices are forced to cost shift to private pay patients who have no insurance. My colleague, Dr. DeColesta, has some specific examples for the committee.
Do
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Pam DeCalesta. My husband and I are both optometric physicians, and we own a three-office practice in Eugene that employs 65 fellow Oregonians. We're also members of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, and I am here to ask for your support for HB 2299. I'd like to provide a brief explanation of the issue at hand. When a patient orders a pair of glasses, the lenses must be fabricated to match the doctor's written prescription and cut to fit the patient's frame. Eye care providers have the option of completing this process themselves, considered an in-house job, or sending out the frame and the prescription to a separate optical laboratory called out-of-house. Our company has proudly maintained an in-house lab for 35 years, allowing us to provide quality materials in a timely manner. In the last 10 years, though, the number of spectacle jobs required to be sent out of house to an insurance carrier mandated lab has more than doubled, from 30% to 70%. There are many ways that the practice of mandating labs impacts our patients. Patient choice can be limited if the type of lens prescribed is not available from the dictated lab, often requiring the patient to choose from brands owned or recommended by the national insurance company. In addition to limitation of choice, our patients are forced to wait longer to receive their glasses when an outside lab is required. For many spectacle orders, our own in-house lab can process within 1 or 2 days. In our experience, it can take 5 days or even longer to send the job out to a required lab. Imagine the impact waiting 5 or more days has on a patient who has lost their glasses and needs them to drive to work. How does this affect Oregon workers and small businesses? Well, our Oregon small business currently employs 5 full-time lab employees and an additional part-time lab employees. If the trend of required out-of-house labs continues, it may diminish our lab work to the point of reducing or completely eliminating our lab employees. We may have to lay off Oregon workers. To compound the issue for Oregon workers, national insurance companies are increasingly requiring that spectacle jobs can only be sent to their wholly owned lab, which is located outside of Oregon. This forces skilled work that could easily be done by Oregon workers in Oregon labs to be shipped to another state. In our practice, at least 40% of insurance company dictated jobs must be sent out of state, and the number is growing every year. HB 2299 will protect the patient's choice of preferred materials and allow them to receive their glasses within a reasonable amount of time. It will also help to protect Oregon's small businesses and keep skilled jobs in Oregon. My husband and I, along with fellow members of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, respectfully request your support for HB 2299. I will now defer to Dr. Hill for a closing statement.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, HB 2299 prevents vision insurance companies from dictating discounts on products and services that they do not cover. Practices may still offer discounts, but should be allowed to use free market economics to determine prices and discounts without being forced to cost shift to patients without coverage. HB 2299 also gives patients and practitioners the ability to choose the optical lens manufacturer that best suits the patient's needs without interference by the insurer. The Oregon Optometric Physicians Association requested this bill to ensure that Oregon citizens have access to quality eye care and materials and to help small local businesses and their employees thrive in our state. I respectfully urge your support for HB 2299, and Dr. DeCalesta and I thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony and would be pleased to answer any additional questions that the committee may have at any time.
Are there any questions?
Vice Chair has one.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Chair Greenlake, thank you. In reading the bill, I have a concern that the insurance companies, there's only, what, 6-7 vision insurance companies in the U.S., I believe. You can correct me if I'm wrong with that. If you get this approved, what is going to keep the insurance companies from continuing to deal with the eye doctors rather than penalize them?
That's an excellent question. I can't confirm the exact number of insurance companies, but that's a believable number. We can confirm that with you. In terms of how this will impact the relationship between the doctors and the insurance companies. It's very heavy-handed right now. We've really got no bargaining power. We're the small guy. They've got all the power. Federal antitrust law prevents us from any kind of organized negotiation. So we're kind of at their mercy. For me, it's approximately 50% of my patients that are on these big insurance companies. And so it's really not economically viable to eliminate that plan. So we're counting on you to help protect us and help us compete in a fair, open market.
Yeah, my concern was just that,
Follow up? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Green. My concern was that the patients that utilize your services may be limited on where they could go.
I have a couple of questions that I may. Under this bill, as I read it in its current form, it would prevent an insurance company from requiring a given provider, even for covered services or a given lab. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, could you please clarify the question, sir?
The question is, can it, under this bill, would it prevent an insurance company from mandating the use of a particular lab, even for covered services?
Nikki Terzia, Chair Greenlick. I don't know about for covered services. What this bill will do will prevent an insurer, a vision plan, from dictating which lab for non-covered lenses, non-covered services.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, to add to what Ms. Terzia just said, they're mandating that we use labs of their choosing for both covered and non-covered services.
Well, I understand that. The question is the effect of the bill to prevent them from naming a lab to be used for services they cover?
I believe it is.
Okay. The next question I have is, what's the intent of the amendment? Is this your amendment? What's the effect of the amendment?
Yes, Chair Greenlick, thank you. The intent of the Dash 1 amendment, there are just a couple of technical pieces, insertions of words, but there is a piece where we're attempting to clarify the term is used credentialing in between an insurer and the provider, and we're attempting to clarify that credentialing may not be what we traditionally think of in terms of education, but that when you accept a medical plan, for instance, and sign on to the medical plan, you are then expected and quote-unquote eligible for a variety of packages on the vision side, on the device side. And so sometimes you will find yourself wanting to choose one plan over another, but you will see them bundled together and you're forced to accept, on occasion, loss leaders.
Representative Widener, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be on it because we've talked about the labs and everything, but it would be essentially like they're telling you what drug to prescribe to a patient. Is that essentially, if you were prescribing a drug, that they're steering you to the drug company that they're using? Would that be a safe way or a safe analogy for us to draw?
So, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, Representative Widener, that's a good analogy. A generic drug is allegedly, it should be, the same chemical composition as a brand name drug. So although the analogy works very well, I want to point out that ophthalmic lenses are vastly different between designs. Blended progressive no-line bifocals, there are many different brands, and those designs are very different. So the analogy is a good one, but I just want to point out that it's really not apples and apples in the case of...
I don't think the analogy is right, because it's not the drug that they're naming, it's the drugstore that they're...
Right.
They're
requiring, yeah.
Yep.
Which is a little different. Well, thank you very much. Let's call the next panel, please.
Dan Heim. I'm not sure if Paul Cosgrove and Dan Jarman are here yet, but Nan, I'll get us going. I'll go down and...
Where would they be?
In another hearing room, testifying at the same time on another bill.
Oh.
we'll see if we get them here.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Nan.
Thank you, Chair Greenlich, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Nan Heim, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. Our members are medical doctors throughout the state specializing in eye care. I won't take up your time other than to say that our academy supports this bill and wanted to be on record in support of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jarman, you're up. Dan, wait a minute. There may be questions. Let's see.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman here today representing United Health Group. I'll be very brief. I had a chance to speak with Mr. Cross on Friday about the bill and his willingness to discuss with us and others some concerns that we have. He has said that this is an attempt to enact legislation that's similar in other states that we have worked with legislatures to on their laws. It is similar but not the same, and so we'd like to work with Mr. Cross to see if we can find some accommodation on some amendments and clarify some concerns that we have with specific provisions. Our concerns may be different than other insurers, but we have two specific concerns we'd like to discuss with the proponents and look forward to doing that.
Which are those?
It would be Section 4 on the credentialing, which I understand there is an amendment. I haven't seen the amendment that may deal with that, so that could be an issue. And then secondly is on the materials issue that you heard discussed earlier. I think an important consideration is the cost aspect, and I know that there will be some information that Mr. Cosgrove will share and probably submit some information about cost to consumer for some of this information and the ability of these vision plans to be able to negotiate with the providers so the consumer at the end of the day can have the best cost for these services. So, again, we look forward to working with proponents of the bill on this legislation and ask the committee for that ability to do so.
Mr. Cosgrove. Representative Widener.
I could just I'm looking at Section 4. It doesn't look like anything's changing in Section 4.
So the dash 1?
So I'm on the original bill. Unless we change
the dash one, changes that.
Dash one had a Section 4. Okay,
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have not seen the amendment, so I'm not sure what happens with the amendment.
The dash 4 takes out line 21 through 45, and 1 through 21 on page 3. So I think if we're talking about the dash 1 as a model, it goes in the direction you want.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Cosco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the National Association of Vision Care Plans. A one-page list of comments on the bill, but not a section by section, was filed in as on OLIS for your review, and I'm just going to highlight a couple of big picture issues. I, too, have spoken briefly, very briefly, with Mr. Cross, and committed. We'll sit down and talk about our concerns in detail with him about this bill. But they do generally fall into two categories. Thank you. One of the categories is we believe that some of these provisions will raise costs for consumers, and others of them are actually anti-consumer in their effect in other ways, not just price. That we have some concerns specifically about a couple of the definitions. Section 4, as has already been mentioned, we also have concerns about part of the provisions in Sections 2 and 3. So we will sit down, and by the time this bill comes back, if it comes back, we will have perhaps some additional amendments. I have also not seen the dash 1, so I can't comment on it this time. But
the dash 1's on
happy
OLIS?
To answer
it
any questions.
Been, yes. They're on OLIS now.
Thank you. We'll go look for it.
Just for the folks that are talking about this bill, I do have some problems with an insurance company not being able to name a laboratory for a coverage service, and we ought to be sort of cautious about that. I think requiring a laboratory for a non-coverage service, that's a whole different ballgame. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2299 and expect to hear again from folks. It's where it's going. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2522. Madam Minister, what do we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have for a public hearing House Bill 2522, which creates the Islander Health Coverage Gap Assessment Office within the Oregon Health Authority. That office will promote access to health care for island citizens residing in the United States under the Compact of Free Association Act. The bill also defines islander and directs OHA to report to the Legislative Assembly and established January 1, 2016 as an operative date, but the bill itself has an emergency clause, and this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
And will you call the first panel, please?
Lloyd Henlon, Joe Enlett, Simon Simeon.
And I hope somebody will start out by explaining what the compact is and why people under the compact are not covered now. That would be very helpful.
I will do that. Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Hayden, Vice Chair Knost. I'm Lloyd Henlon, and I'm a member of the CAN organization. That stands for COFA Alliance National Network. And the name COFA stands for the Compact of Free Association. And the United States has three unique treaties with only three island nations. So I say they're unique because these treaties allow the people from these three island nations, which is the Marshall Islands, the Federated States of Micronesia, and the Republic of Palau, to come to visit and stay and work in the United States on a permanent basis as long as they want. They pay all local, state, and federal taxes. But, you know, we've had some major oversights with these good people. Even though we have a missile base, the Ronald Reagan ballistic missile base in the Marshall Islands, it's a major employer of the people, by the way. Even though we have that, and they join our military in numbers that at higher percentages than any states, we still, the oversights were that we took Medicaid away in 1996 at the federal level, and we also were issuing them until this body corrected that oversight in 2013, temporary driver's license cards, and I want to thank Representative Brian Klim and Representative Vicky Berger for co-sponsoring that bill. And it passed the legislature once they saw the oversight with no negative votes. Where, of course, now we have the major bill here, which is a health care bill. Because these folks, even though they're here legally, they cannot get Medicaid. And it's, I think of this a great oversight. Now, they do get some medical assistance in some other states, but not in Oregon. They do get it under Obamacare. But as soon as they lose their job or don't have a job, then they go off from health care insurance. So with me today is the president of our organization, Joe Enlett, who will be speaking next. And we have a group of people from the islands, from the COFA nations that are here too, supporting us. And we have also the National Association of Atomic Veterans that are here, and they would like to say a few words because they have been victimized by the 60s, by the bomb testing and as well. There were 67 bomb tests in the Marshall Islands, maybe all of you know that, between 45 and 58. And the people from these islands suffer from the highest rates of cancer and renal diseases and other radiation-related diseases, higher rates than any other population in the United States. And my wife is an ICU nurse at Salem Hospital. She took care of one of these victims, a young lady who had five children, and she died. So this is the kind of tragedy that we run into. So thank you.
Answer, we have a long list of witnesses in this bill.
I'm through with my testimony.
I'd like you all to hold your testimony to 2 minutes, if you will.
Got it.
We'll try and get through this list. But before you go, would you say specifically what this bill does?
This bill sets up an assessment gap office to promote and assess the depth and of the medical assistance issue with these people. And
but not in this version to actually provide service. This would be to look at how to deal with the issue.
It's basically an assessment and how to deal with it.
Good.
And that's what the office would do.
Thank you.
Chair.
Please go ahead.
Hi. Chair Greenlich, Vice Chair Hayden, and Vice Chair Nose, and committee members. Thank you for having us today. I am Joe Inlet, the president of the COFA Alliance National Network that started here in Oregon. And like Mr. Henyon mentioned, we are here as a community to ask for your support of this bill. It is estimated that there are about 4,500 to 5,400 COFA persons who were born in their home islands now legally residing in Oregon. Many work in the service industries and other industries and other low-paying positions. Often their children are born in the United States and are therefore U.S. citizens, while their parents are not. And because of that, they are excluded from the basic health care benefits and other safety net programs. So more than just Medicaid, they also don't qualify for other federally funded programs. We do work diligently to raise our families. We pay all of our taxes, and many of our sons and daughters have joined the military. And many of them have also paid the price with their lives. So what CAN is poised to do is to correct this fundamental injustice that was the taking away of Medicaid benefits from COFA citizens in 1996 due to the Welfare Reform Act. So for the last 17 years, we have tried to correct this at the federal level, and it has not gone through. So we are asking Oregon, which has one of the biggest populations of COFA citizens anywhere in the United States, to take this opportunity to correct this injustice. And HB 2522 is very important to the COFA community here in Oregon, and I think it will set also precedents that might help other states to look into this, to start correcting this. And it will allow Oregon to take a clearer and more informed look at COFA people who are here, particularly under the treaty. And many of our people suffer from, as Henyon mentioned, thyroid cancer, a lot of diabetes, and many other diseases, chronic diseases. I would like now to pass it on to,
Yes. Representative Bueller, do you have a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Is there a unique responsibility the state of Oregon has to the island peoples that would differ from other states?
I don't think so. I think that because the Oregon state has the largest number of COFA citizens here, but we do pay into our taxes here. Many of us are working in many of the industries here, so I think there is a responsibility for the state to help us out as citizens.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for having us sitting down here. My name is Simon Simeon. I'm from Duke State. I have a brother named Roger who moved to Portland, Oregon, several years ago after living in Hawaii and New Jersey for many years. He came here so that his four children can have a better life. His family of seven, including a elderly aunt who helped with childcare. Roger worked as an interpreter for 4 years in a court system, in hospital, clinic, and school. He has been paying his tax for at least 20 years that he worked in the United States, and he has been a great help to the Chukis community in Oregon. And yet, even though he is working and legally living in the U.S., he has not been able to see the doctor because he makes just enough to pay their bills and cannot afford health insurance. He also does not qualify for Medicaid. So when he gets sick, he just wait and hope that he can get better. The elder Nihant living with them in 70 plus years old. She's suffering from severe asthma and other sickness, but she can see the doctor to get better. The only time that she sees a doctor is when she had an attack and passed out. She had almost died a few times. She's getting weaker every day. Very soon she will not be able to function. I ask you today to please vote for these bills because many people like my brother Roger have the same exact situation. Many of our people are dying very young because they cannot see their doctor even though they are working hard and pay their taxes. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Good time. All right, we're going to call the next panel. We have lots of witnesses. We're going to end this hearing no later than 2 o'clock because we have a big group next. So please continue to be brief. Madam Minister?
Ken Geyer.
So, Kenny Geyer, please call the next panel.
John, I have questions for a panel.
Oh, all right.
John Roten, Fred Schaefer, and Gary Smith.
Speak up, ma'am.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah.
How many of these?
Yes, Chairperson and Committee. My name is Fred Schaefer, and I am the National Commander for the National Association of Atomic Veterans. And we have sort of common grounds for what the Marshall Islanders have. We went to their island, and we participated in those atomic tests. And we have, this last year, we want to help support them in everything we can here in the state of Oregon. And just be there, because we have some of the same problems with our veterans. And we've been before you, and you have been so nice to us in the past, and we'll be before you again. Thank you. Any questions?
We'll keep trying to be nice.
John?
John Roten, I'm a Navy veteran that was on Operation Hardtack in 1958. While I was there, I was present. There was 22 bombs detonated while I was there, 20 above ground and 2 below water. And I'm here just from the problems I've had dealing with the veterans to support these people because I know firsthand what they're going through. Any way I can support them and help, and I will, and I wish that none of us had to have gone through that, but in life it ain't what you want you get, it's what you get. And so all I can say is I support them, and I hope you will too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your service. We very much appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Gary Smith. I'm the state commander for the National Association of Atomic Veterans. And I don't want to try to moralize or rationalize what our government did during this testing process, but it involved American servicemen, civilians, and many people on the various islands. And I know as a victim of ionized radiation, I'm missing my bladder, prostate gland, left kidney, few feet of intestines. And so I know what the ravages of ionized radiation can do to a person. And I feel that the Marshall Islanders, through no fault of their own, were subjected to the similar types of things that I was subjected to. And I just want to say that I feel that the American government and Oregonians, as part of the American government, owe these people a debt that we can't repay. And I feel that their effort to obtain various benefits should be promoted. I feel, and most of all, as a taxpayer, I feel that my taxes going towards this endeavor is a well-spent tax dollar. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions to this panel? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little more of a comment and everything, but like to thank you for your service and everything. I actually learned a lot about the Pacific Islanders when we were doing the World War II Memorial with Colonel Leonard DeWitt, who served there and spent a lot of time, and he's taught us a lot. And you guys were a great asset to the U.S., and I thank you for your service and the Pacific Islanders for all the help that they gave us during World War II.
Thank you very much, team.
Wayne Brooks, then we'll go into Joseph Santos Lyons and Felicia Higgins.
Mr. Chairman.
Always good morning if you're optimistic.
My name is Wayne Brooks, and I'm an atomic veteran from 1958, Aniwetok, Bikini. We fired 32 atomic bombs underwater and above water, as he was saying, some in the on Bikini Island. And there's islands in Bikini right now, the atoll of Bikini, that are covered with 8 feet of cement because they're so hot. These people can never go home. And I just would like to say that all the atomic veterans are pulling for these people, because I'll tell you, we saw things that nobody has ever seen before. I came in contact with some Bikini people that they were trying to get home, and my ship was a destroyer, and we're out on patrolling the areas around the atomic test. And here's this boat trying to get back to their home. And high waves, and they were sinking. We pulled alongside, got them, and pulled them out, and had to take them to Kwajalein because they can't go back to Bikini or any we talk. And the bombs there, I mean, if you want to get into it, was a 5 megaton, but they misjudged it, and it turned out to be 11 megaton, which if you want to do it, it's 11 million tons of TNT equivalency. And these people need all the help they can get.
Is it? Are we talking about basically the Marshall Islands? Is it also true of Palau and Micronesia?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, in terms of the atomic testing?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thanks for having us today. My name is Joseph Santos Lyons. I'm the executive director of APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. I think the folks who come before me have said much of what I wanted to say, so I just wanted to add that this has the full support of APANO and the Oregon Health Equity Alliance, as well as the Oregon Commission on Asian Pacific Islander Affairs. And we really are always moved when the communities who are most impacted have a leadership role in crafting sort of the policy solutions to address the needs in their communities. And in many ways, this doesn't quite go far enough, and that the issues affecting the Compact of Free Association folks who live here in Oregon need to be looked at even more broadly. To me, this is a very conservative and measured but reasonable step for Oregon to take. There is an effort sort of federally to have congressional action move to support the needs of these folks across the country and in some of the U.S. territories where they have migrated to as a result of our involvement and our militarization of their islands. But as one of the elders said, you know, we are here because you were there. And so it's our hope that you will fully support this measure. And if you do have any concerns, to please come and talk and work with us. We also appreciate the support and leadership of Representative Brian Klem, who has been sort of a leader in sort of bringing these issues to the attention of the legislature.
He would have been here today, but he has a family emergency.
He does, yeah. So what I would also just leave you with is, you know, expect us back. I think we really want to be able to address this not only from an analysis and an assessment standpoint, but also from a solution standpoint. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alicia. Chair Greenlick, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director for the Service Employees International Union, Local 49. I'm here on behalf of SEIU. SEIU represents 65,000 workers in the state of Oregon. Many of them work in low-wage occupations, and many of them are Pacific Islanders. And our experience with organizing and working with this group of folks is that they're incredibly dedicated to their jobs, but oftentimes they're in employment where healthcare is not offered or has actually been taken away after the Affordable Care Act was passed, with the assumption that everybody could get access through the healthcare exchanges or through the Medicaid enrollment. That hasn't been the case. And so now you have people who are in the United States legally working very hard in their employment who are not even offered a healthcare benefit. Which has huge impacts on themselves and their families. We're also very supportive of this bill, and I would echo what Mr. Santos Lyons just said, that we believe that this doesn't go far enough. You've heard incredible testimony from folks in the audience today who we think that this should be opening up services to these folks who are, again, legally present in the United States, who are here working, who have come from countries where they deserve the right and access to benefits here in our state in Oregon. We shouldn't wait for the federal government. We should begin to act now. I'm happy to take any questions. We'll be supporting House Bill 2522.
Okay, Gar.
Thank you to this panel and the ones before it. It's incredibly compelling testimony. And I wanted to just ask a couple questions, if it's okay, Chair,
yes,
to
please.
Understand the issue. So these folks came over to this country as legal immigrants, and in the agreement to bring them over here, there was an agreement struck that they would not have access to Medicaid. Is that correct?
So originally, there was access to Medicaid and other federal benefits until the 1996 the federal welfare reform that was enacted that excluded this group, which really had no voice in the federal decision at the time.
Okay.
Folks have really been immigrating here since the 50s, mm-hmm. Including to Oregon, across Oregon, not only Marion County, but there's a large Micronesian and Palauan community in La Grande, mm-hmm. as well as in the Lane County and Southern Oregon areas. And so
suddenly this group of people who had access to this suddenly did not as of 1996.
That's correct.
That population presumably will be declining. Their children are now not a part of COFA. They're American citizens.
That's
what
correct.
Number in Oregon are members of COFA?
So we estimate between 4,000 to 6,000 are COFA citizens. Not all of them would necessarily meet the income eligibility for Oregon Health Plan or other sort of benefits that would be federally subsidized.
Are they eligible for the exchange?
They are eligible for the exchange. Yeah.
But so they're not.
If they can afford it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Felisa Higgins, again, they are eligible for the exchange. However, they are not eligible for the tax credits that are offered on the exchange. So they have to pay full price for the health plans that are offered on the exchange. And because many of these folks work in low-wage jobs, the issue is they would pay the full price for the health care, and often that's almost their entire income for the month.
So follow-up, Mr. Chair? Thank you. So what – this is, like, a huge travesty. What have other states done to address this problem, aside from setting up mm-hmm. an office of assessment with a $100,000 appropriation request? I mean, it seems obvious that we should be covering these people. Are there other states that have done that?
So I think Joe can speak more to this, Joe Enlett, but I can definitely say that several states, Hawaii, California, and Washington, have created provisions to provide health access for folks who meet the low-income eligibility, but it's not always full inclusion into the Medicaid program.
That's pretty much it.
Okay. Also Utah, apparently, right? Yes. So we'll get more information about all that, and we can provide it to the committee.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great. Do you have another comment you want
to make? No. Yeah. He's sort of, he's our expert.
Thank you very much. We have four more. Okay. Four more folks. Let's take the next three.
Mike Barong, Deanna Angelo, and Horgan, and I'm sorry I can't read your writing, from Living Islands Organization.
And the fourth person will be?
Okay. Jesper Angelo.
Just like the only group of legal immigrants, aside from the five-year bar that all legal immigrants have.
Are you Mike Barong? Thank you.
I think it's only Mike Barong this time. Yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Great. It's only Mike Barong this time.
Okay. And one other then?
Horgan, and I don't see any movement on Horgan Cohen. Anyway, yes.
Hi. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Mike Barong, as you said. I am from Federated States of Micronesia, one of the co-foundations. I am here to read you a testimony from a friend of mine, also from Micronesia. His name is Virgil Sikra. And I will go ahead and read his testimony, which is pretty much common among us COFA citizens here, the experience that he went through and so on. From Virgil Sikra, his letter is saying, I am writing in support of House Bill 2522, health care for COFA citizens, islanders residing in Oregon, and share my personal experience of health care services and benefits received from Medicaid health program. On January 24th, 2014, I was admitted and hospitalized at the Salem Hospital Intensive Care Unit due to my serious health condition for 7 days. During my hospital stay, a family member helped me complete an application for Medicaid as I was incapacitated and did not have medical insurance. My medical application was denied due to an error on my application. After several attempts of making appropriate corrections on my application and 9 months of waiting, I received my medical health insurance letter with a coverage dated effective October 20, 2014. This means that Medicaid did not cover my hospital medical bill of $80,000. I contacted the health plan and inquired about the effective date on my health care coverage and was told that my benefits will not cover retro for the date of my hospital stay. I contacted the Salem Hospital regarding a payment arrangement and financial assistance. Salem Hospital waived my large medical bill due to my financial hardship, which I am forever grateful for. I have been seen a neurologist 3 times for follow-up and since my hospitalization. Although these medical visit services are needed in order to help control and stabilize my chronic health condition, they are not covered under my current health benefits plan with Citizen Alliance Waiver Emergence Medical Program. I am making payment arrangement with my neurologist with the limited financial help I receive from my family and friends. I am still unemployed due to my serious health condition, and I am in process of applying for disability through Social Security Administration. Thank you for your valuable time and consideration. Sincerely, Virgil Sikra.
Thank you very much.
That's all.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Is there anybody else we're missing on this? Is somebody else signed up that we've missed?
Are you Morgan?
You're allowed to. Okay, good. We'll be back to look at this bill in a work session. I suspect it has to go to Ways and Means, so that's where the action will probably be on this, but we'll figure it out. In the meantime, make sure the proponents stay in touch. I will close public hearing on House Bill 2522 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2546. We'll take a minute. We'll stand at ease while some folks leave. See if we can gather some folks back up.
It's very weird. And I remember asking about it because I haven't thought about it again until now, but I remember hearing about it.
Talk in front. It just seems so.
And I think they have so little lobbying power. But like, why would they specifically carve it up?
You know that.
That's why I was thinking maybe it went back to earlier when they agreed to bring it over. Like, okay, we'll let you all immigrate here. As long as you don't get right. I could see it if it went back. I don't get why it would have been part of the 96 welfare report. It just makes no sense to me. Well, Doug.
Okay. Let's come back to order, please.
Why would they be excluded?
We have opened a public hearing.
Number 4 in diabetes.
On House Bill whatever. 2546.
Did you just say whatever?
Yeah, I did. Representative Taylor, are you the lead off today? I'm honored with these guests from the Senate. We're very good place to see. And we are going to end on time, which means 2:45. So after this panel, if everybody would keep their remarks short, it would be very helpful.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Taylor, State Representative for House District 41, which includes Milwaukee, Oak Grove, and parts of Southeast Portland. I'm here today with Senators.
Put it down a little.
Yeah. I'm here today with Senators Elizabeth Steiner Hayward and Senator Lori Montes Anderson. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about House Bill 2546, which pertains to electronic cigarettes. Specifically, HB 2546 prohibits the sale of inhalant delivery systems to minors. That definition will be defined formally in a moment. It applies all age-restricted regulation of tobacco products to e-cigarettes and includes the prohibition of use of e-cigarettes in the Indoor Clean Air Act. E-cigarettes pose a significant health risk to individuals, especially young people, and to others when smoked indoors. We've been successful in decreasing the rate of tobacco use among teens, but teen use of e-cigarettes is on the rise, threatening that success. This bill was developed during the interim under the leadership of former Representative Tomei, Representatives Greenlick and Barnhart, Senator Steiner Hayward and Montes Anderson, and I served on the work group as well, along with a wide group of stakeholders, including medical professionals, agency personnel, health advocates, local governments, business interests, an e-cigarette retailer, and many others. In addition, I want to draw attention to the letters of support from the Oregon Medical Association, Oregon Nurses Association, Oregon Department of Justice, the Building Owners and Managers Association, the Association of Oregon Counties, as well as several individual county letters, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. I apologize if I did not mention them all. This group was meticulous in crafting definitions, and we have had extensive discussions about the precise language and details of the bill, as Mark Mayer, the LC drafter, is here to explain. In addition, our work group was very forward-thinking, recognizing the likelihood of Passage 91, the Marijuana Initiative, which is why marijuana is included in the language of House Bill 2546. When someone uses an inhalant delivery system, one cannot tell what kind of juice is being smoked. The juice may contain nicotine, it may contain a candy-flavored liquid, or it may contain marijuana. If we allow e-cigarettes, or inhalant delivery systems, to be used in restaurants, movie theaters, workplaces, etc., then it will be nearly impossible for a citizen, a store owner or employee, or law enforcement to determine whether or not someone is using an inhalant delivery system to smoke marijuana. So in addition to the usual health advocates that we worked with, law enforcement is in strong support of the Indoor Clean Air Act provisions of this bill and will be testifying shortly. Enforcement of the new marijuana laws are going to be complicated enough without also having indoor e-cigarette use in the mix. My comments are intended to be brief, and I'm going to turn it over to Elizabeth Steiner Hayward and to Senator Manas Anderson, and then we will hopefully have Mark Mayer from LC come up and talk. I urge your support for House Bill 2546. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. One or the other.
Oh, I guess I'm next. Hi, everyone. I'm State Senator Lori Manas Anderson. I represent East Multnomah County, Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and parts of East Portland. And the only comments I have to add here is the FDA has started to propose rules on this. But in the absence of strong federal regulations, I feel strongly that Oregon needs to lead the way by restricting the e-cigarette purchased by minors, restricting marketing targeted at children and adolescents, and restricting the use of the devices in public places. As a public health nurse, we had spent years in the 90s in targeting stop smoking cessation programs, and it was effective. And I just feel that we have worked so hard with these campaigns in the past to discourage the habit and the use of tobacco and products with nicotine. Young people can get hooked, and we have to prevent this. So our focus really needs to be on preventing the use. I know that e-cigarettes are touted by some as being a safer alternative. Some argue e-cigarettes can help people quit smoking, but evidence supports that they don't really help people quit, or they are about as effective as a nicotine patch. With the e-cigarette use more than doubling use among middle and high school students, we need to be very forward in passing legislation that is going to restrict these young people from getting addicted. Thank you.
Thank you.
And my testimony, I'm sorry, is in OLIS if you want to look at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from Northwest Portland, Beaverton, unincorporated Washington County, also Associate Professor of Family Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University, although I'm speaking on behalf of myself, not the university. I would echo all the things my colleagues have said. I would add a couple of other points. The first is this issue of inhaled delivery systems. Why are we choosing to call it that in the bill rather than e-cigarettes? Primarily because we think that we're going to be playing catch-up to the industry on a regular basis. So as we thought about looking forward and not wanting to have to change laws every 2 to 4 years as new devices for getting these things into your lungs become available, we decided to have a pretty broad definition. We were careful to make sure that people who use prescription inhalers and things like that for FDA-approved purposes are protected. So if you've got your asthma inhaler, you're okay under this law. But even if e-cigarettes were ultimately approved by the FDA for smoking cessation, because they would still be marketed for recreational purposes as well, they would still fall under the definition of inhaled delivery systems. Certainly the points that my colleagues have made about law enforcement, about law-abiding owners, store owners not being able to tell things apart, are very important. I would also add that we are already beginning to see evidence that there are a variety of toxic chemicals that are released by both to the user and to people around them, such as formaldehyde, when these liquids are heated. Now, at the moment, the research was done on particularly high temperatures, and the industry may be claiming that we don't think this happens at regular temperatures. I don't think we can be so sure of that. I don't think we've done our full analysis of all the things that are in there. I personally really don't want to be inhaling these chemicals when I'm near somebody who's using one of these devices in a closed space. This is fairly straightforward. This is for protecting our Oregonians. This is for keeping these things out of the hands of our kids, and I urge your support. Thank you.
On the home questions, so we hear Mr. Meyer walk through. Is that the intention, to walk through the bill?
Yes. But Widener.
Thanks. You want to wait, or you want to do it now?
I have some amendments, and I just wanted to see if
they were open to them, or maybe we could wait until later.
Go ahead, why don't you?
We can do it now.
So, since it's your bill and everything, I figured you'd be appropriate for this. So I've met with different sides and everything, and everybody's got mixed emotions on these with them just coming out. I know guys that smoked that have quit smoking, and they're using one of these devices now, and I think it's healthier for them rather than taking in the smoke itself than what they were doing. But I'm just wondering, would you be open? One of the amendments I have is just allowing like a bar that has a full OLCC license to actually buy a or go through the Oregon Health Authority and get registered or be a place where they could actually allow vaping in their facility and everything. So you have, it's 21 and over establishment. Because right now, lots of times you'll drive down the street, you'll see people standing in front of a bar out there smoking cigarettes with your kids, and it's glorifying smoking. And I see this as something that kind of transfer the smoking over. So that's the reason I drafted that amendment. And I don't know if you guys are open to that amendment at all.
I don't think this would. I mean, I think we ought to do is you ought to let them know what your amendments are, and then you can talk about it as with them outside. I don't think we want to.
Then the others are some sunsets, so we come back and revisit them. So just to give you an idea.
We'll look forward to hearing more details. Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, we'll look forward to hearing more details, and we're happy to have a conversation with you. We're interested in your thoughts.
I think you had two others, one you just want to mention to them. Put on the
one
record.
Of them's just clarifying the definition, some of the definitions and everything, kind of cleaning that statute up, and then having a sunset so we're back here in 4 years looking when we have more evidence and stuff coming in to realize, do we want to keep this as part of the Clean Indoor Act or not, so we keep the dialogue and conversation going, because we might find this is something that really curbs smoking and starts deterring it and changes things. So that's why I have these amendments.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, as I said, we're more than happy to continue to have conversations. I would like to comment on one thing you said, if I may, Mr. Chair. I would certainly agree that overall, at the moment, based on what we know, if I have somebody who's smoking regular cigarettes on a frequent basis, you know, pack a day, two pack a day smoker, and they're able to switch to e-cigarettes, overall, I think that's a net win. The small particulate matter is substantially higher in smoke, regular smoke from tobacco or other plant-based substances that people smoke, than it is from the liquids that are usually used in these devices. So, yes, I agree. There are people who are taking advantage of these devices to help get them away from traditional cigarettes. Our concern is that we don't want these to serve as a gateway, if you will, to people smoking regular cigarettes, because they start out with the nicotine in e-cigarettes, and that's one of our bigger concerns. And thank you.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Briefly, please.
Just so you know my mindset, I'm looking at this kind of like prohibition. As soon as you tell people they can't have something, you're kind of creating that environment where they want to go get it. So I'm looking at ways to transfer people from cigarette smoking into using these devices, and then eventually to where they start getting away from nicotine devices because of all the tar and everything else you find in cigarettes.
You should put an amendment in that you could only sell these to people who are current smokers.
We can throw that one in, too. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
That kind of goes against the prohibition.
I think with a few more beers, we could come up with better than that.
Yeah, you need to take Representative Barker and Kevin Campbell. Mark?
All right, all three.
Oh, yeah.
Mark, come on. Representative Barker, Mr. Campbell.
Right.
You want to join us?
Them and then Mark.
Is this the handsome brother?
Oh, yes.
Good. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. I'm here today to testify on the House bill and Senate bill. And what I would like to just say is we'd like clear, bright lines on this, and we are asking that you prohibit vaping where smoking is prohibited. And the reason for this is, I expect the marijuana committee to come out with no marijuana use in public. If people are allowed to vape whatever in public, somebody's going to complain, I believe, and thinking that the vapor is using marijuana. And if that's the case, then the police have to come out, and then there's the interaction there that may or may not result in a good outcome. And I would like clear, bright lines for law enforcement so that they don't get called, and every time somebody sees somebody vaping, you know, in public, that they think it's marijuana, and especially inside, for example, a movie theater or a restaurant or someplace. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Campbell?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm here today on behalf of the chiefs and the sheriffs to speak in support of House Bill 2546. And I do like to consider myself the handsome one of the two brothers. The other one evidently needs hair in order to enhance his look. I do not need any of that help.
It's pure out there.
Yeah, and you'd probably like me to stick to the issue at hand, so I will. our support for this bill, as Representative Barker has already indicated, is that, as you know, where there is a lack of clear parameters, law enforcement ends up in encounters that we don't want to be involved in. Calls for service where someone is unclear about what's allowed and not allowed, both for the public, general public, and for businesses that interact with people that may or may not be using these devices, it can create confusion, and law enforcement is just brought in more often. For the officer and for everybody involved, clarity is very important, and it's critical to what we do. We believe House Bill 2546 accomplishes that purpose. We believe in terms of educating the public and letting them know what's allowed and not allowed is not difficult in light of the way this is structured. And we feel confident that this bill addresses an issue that, by the way, ended up on our priority list with the chiefs of police of the state. So as the chiefs began to talk about issues that were important during this session, this issue of the lack of regulation around these devices was a priority interest. Part of that is because what they see with regard to youth. Part of it also has to do with the fact that a lack of definition in this area creates all kinds of challenges for officers that have an increasingly complex job to do as it is. And this is, to our minds, helpful. And so both for the chiefs of police and the sheriffs, I want to thank you for this opportunity to allow me to come up with Representative Barker in particular and to share those brief thoughts. I'll submit testimony in writing with additional detail, but I did want to get something on the record. So thank you.
The questions, Representative Barker, Campbell.
And the only thing, Mr. Chairman, I don't believe I identified myself for the record. I'm Representative Jeff Barker, House District 28. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Meyer, are you going to walk us through the bill?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair, Representative, I apologize if I don't pronounce this correctly, Nose.
You did.
I did. Okay, thank you. And Vice Chair Hayden. My name is Mark Mayer from Legislative Council. I was asked to come today to walk the committee through the bill and answer any questions about it. I did want to clarify one point that was mentioned just a minute ago. Measure 91 does prohibit the use of marijuana in a public place. And the definition of public place under Measure 91 is very broad. It includes not only indoor establishments, it also includes outdoor places like parks, areas of mass transit, things like that. So there is already a prohibition in 91 on use of marijuana in a public place. So one of the things I was asked to testify today is about the overlap between this bill and Measure 91, how the two intersect, and answer any questions along those lines. But for now, I'm going to go back to the bill. I can answer those questions in a minute. So the bill really does two primary things. It establishes a definition with regard to tobacco use by minors in this state, and it establishes a definition with regard to inhalant delivery system use in public places. And then it establishes equal provisions so that those provisions of law apply equally to what common parlance is electronic cigarette. It applies equally to those as it does currently to tobacco. There are other substantive provisions in the bill, which I will also mention as I go through the bill. So most of the action in the bill is in Section 1, page 2. And I'm just going to read straight from the bill because I think that's the best way to look at the language, and then I'll go over the criteria for what the definition means. Inhalant delivery system means, 1, a device that can be used to deliver nicotine or cannabinoids in the form of a vapor or aerosol to a person inhaling from the device. So the first thing to remember is that the device has to be able to be used to deliver either nicotine or cannabinoids. It can be a device that can also deliver other things, but if it can't deliver one of those two things, it's not going to fall within the definition. Mm. Two, in the form of a vapor or aerosol. So, and those are very slight terms. Vapor is a little bit of a broader term. Aerosol means cloud with particulate matter. Vapor means basically almost any type of cloud substance. To a person inhaling from the device. So there's a third criterion, which that you have to be breathing in from the device. Two, or, so this is important, or it also means this other thing, not both of these things together, a component of a device described in this subparagraph, or a substance in any form sold for the purpose of being vaporized or aerosolized by a device described in this subparagraph. So the way that we looked at this as at a committee, is that a component of one of these devices? It's like a component of a car, your muffler, your fender, those types of things. And then the substance would be the gas you put in the car, or it would be the vapor solution that you're putting into the electronic cigarette. And my understanding is, you can ask experts about this a little bit later on, but my understanding is the vapor can be sold in various ways in order to be used with these devices, whether it's cartridges or solutions that are added directly to the device or something like that. There's all different types of ways that it can be added. And then finally, we have an exclusion from the definition. Inhalant delivery system does not include, and so we're taking back out of the definition, any product that has been approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration for sale as a tobacco cessation product or for any other therapeutic use, if the product is marketed and sold solely for that approved purpose. And I thought that the Senator Steiner Hayward explained that pretty well earlier, where if one of these devices does get approved by the FDA for as a cessation product, if it's not marketed and sold purely for that cessation purpose, it will still be within the definition. Then the major part of this bill up to page 7 is mainly updating statutes that mention tobacco products with respect to use by minors, so that includes references to inhalant delivery system. I will mention that there are some other substantive provisions. I'd be happy to field questions on these. On page 2, about the manner in which these things can be distributed or sold by people who choose, by retailers of them. So there's a few substantive provisions about the manner in which they can be sold. But for now, I'm going to jump ahead to the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act, which is on page 7. This was a little bit harder to deal with, and it's because when you're at the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act, it prohibits an act. It prohibits smoking. And so we're looking at a prohibition on the act of vaporizing. But again, there are a lot of different things that can be put into these devices, and it's difficult for people to tell what you're using them for. So what we did with this is we created a definition of inhalant. Inhalant means nicotine or cannabinoid or other substance that is in a form that allows the nicotine, cannabinoid, or substance to be delivered into the person's respiratory system. So that's the first thing. It can't be something that that is in a form that won't allow it to be delivered into your body. It has to be in that form in the first place. And then second, this is the important part, is inhaled for the purpose of delivering the nicotine, cannabinoid, or other substance into the person's respiratory system. So there's an intent component here. You have to be intending to bring it, to breathe it in. It can't be something that you're accidentally breathing in or something that's for some other purpose. Aerosols, they're not used for the purpose of breathing them into your respiratory system. They're used for the purpose of masking odor and that sort of thing. Then finally, we again take something out of the definition, is not approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration for therapeutic purpose, or if approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration for therapeutic purpose, is not marketed and sold solely for that purpose. So again, we took that FDA component and we removed those from the definition. There were a couple of amendments that have been posted on OLIS that I was asked to go over as well. They're very simple. They're fix-it amendments. The one would simply add to the definition of inhalant for purposes of the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act the language, or admitted by a device approved by. So if you look at page 7, line 37, not only is it a substance not approved by the U.S. FDA, it also has to be, it could also be a substance that is emitted by a device approved by the U.S. FDA. And that's because, of course, the FDA approves both devices and drugs. So we went ahead and we added that in to make it clear that anything approved by the FDA isn't going to fall within the definition. And then secondly, the dash twos, in current statute underneath the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, a licensed healthcare facility can allow, it doesn't have to, it's not a mandate, but it can allow the medical use of marijuana on its premises. So we went ahead and we drafted a reference to that to exempt the use of medical marijuana at a licensed healthcare facility that chooses to allow that use on its premises to be exempt from the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act portion of this bill. I think that that's pretty much the only thing that I have to cover today. If you have any questions about any other substantive provision of the bill or about how it intersects with Measure 91, I'd be happy to field those now. Are there any questions?
Okay. I'm getting there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about how it intersects with the marijuana bill. And under Section 5, there are a variety of different situations referring to the endangering the welfare of a minor, and most of those start with the age of 18.
Correct.
And I'm wondering if this needs to specifically call out something about under the age of 21 with regard to marijuana, since that is the legal age.
Correct. That is a very good question. The thing to remember is that Measure 91 is going to be a statute that law enforcement can rely on, as are these statutes. Okay, if you look at endangering the welfare of a minor as a crime statute now, it only applies to people 18 and under. That's the statute we've updated here, including with respect to controlled substances underneath the current statute. Mm-hmm. So that 18 age limit, even with respect to controlled substances, is part of endangering the welfare of a minor currently. The thing to remember about the age difference, though, is that there are going to be, the DA is going to have a choice as to which law they're going to apply when they're looking. This particular thing, it's aimed mainly at the devices themselves. And, of course, we don't know if a device is going to have a cannabinoid solution in it or if it's going to have a nicotine solution in it. But the idea is to give them the enforcement power with respect to these laws with regard to being able to look at that. So I think that's a pretty good question, but these are still consistent with how these laws apply to controlled substances now. But the DAs will have a choice of law to apply. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This committee is over at 2:45. And we're not going to get through the list. So here's my plan. I'm going to call a panel now of people in opposition, all three of whom have checked that they're more than 100 miles from here. If there's anybody else that's come from more than 100 miles, please let our staff know. And I'll call another panel of supporters and another panel of opposition if we still have time. So let's call the next panel, please.
Tim Churchill. John Michaels, Spencer Knowles.
Okay, good. In any order, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Tim Churchill. We're from Medford, Oregon, and we agree with the restrictions in your proposed bill to prohibit sales to minors, anybody under the age of 18. However, on the bill HB 2546, we would like to vote for the dash 8 amendment on that. And I believe that was drawn up earlier today or just recently. We got to review that. It's imperative to the vaping stores that the customers be allowed to try the product, to switch from smoking, or to be able to know what to purchase. And we look at this as a huge harm reduction device. Myself, my personal self, I smoked for 30 years, and I have not had a cigarette for a year and a half, and I cannot tell you how much better I feel. And when we look at this industry of the electronic cigarettes, the main thing I think of is the harm reduction. And my thoughts to you is, I know you have a lot of laws, a lot of stuff to go over. That's the biggest thing in my mind that I see, is not hampering that harm reduction by any laws that you pass.
Thank you.
Might be good for me to go next. My name is Spencer Knowles. I'm from Bend. I have a shop myself, a vape shop. And just really quick, I'd like to agree with a fellow from EC Liquids here. I don't want minors to have this in the possession. We're already an 18 and up shop, as is everyone in the state. And I'm not concerned with it being used in public, to be honest with you. I am very concerned about people continuing smoking. So I'd like to just take you through the process for the moment, and forgive me, I'm a little nervous. This is the first time I've done anything like
great.
This, but it's kind of exciting.
Great.
So what happens when somebody comes in as an interested in an e-cigarette? They look at me and they say, I don't know anything about this. And I know I only have a minute. This will take a moment.
A little further from the mic.
Oh, okay.
I just want to make sure you're on the record.
Yeah, you're too close in it.
Headphone here. So someone will walk in, usually somebody over 60, says, I've been smoking 20 or 30 years. What is this all about? I'll introduce them to the concept of inhaling evaporated liquid as opposed to inhaling combusted smoke. Now, the health services representative before me, I don't remember her title, but I think she kind of agreed with me, and that the particulates of evaporated liquid are much less harmful than combusted smoke. So explain that concept to them at first. And then I'll explain to them that we have several different flavors of nicotine liquid, anything to suit your palate. However, we want to find something that's going to work for you, that's going to substitute that cigarette. So the next step is to take them to the area where we let them try the product. And to me, that's integral, letting them try the product in the shop. Because what that does is it not only gives them the different experience of not having that horrible cigarette taste and shows them there's something that gives them that release from their compulsion, the nicotine, in a more pleasurable experience, but it also allows me to find their nicotine level, which is very important. If I don't key them into the correct nicotine potency, and all of our flavors come in different potencies to satisfy those people who have different tolerance to the drug nicotine, if I can't find the right level, this product won't work for them. And if it won't work for them, how am I of service to them? So if they can't try the product in the shop, and I can't let them try the various nicotine levels, I'm not really providing a very good service to them. That would bring me into the internet. The internet's our major competition. Everything comes from China nowadays, including e-juice. I regulate my e-juice. I get it from USA-approved sources, and we know everything that goes into that. If I lose my usage in the shop, I'm closing my doors. Pretty much everybody who has a shop is going to close their doors because the internet is offering all of this at half the price. They're offering way more selection, but it's an unregulated industry. To be honest with you, it's not as safe from the internet. So to me, if you go ahead and take the Clean Air Act and apply it to inside of my shop, I have to close my business. I've got 8 employees. They'll lose their jobs. And those people who are looking to actually quit smoking using e-cigarettes will be subject to the internet. And we all know how reliable the internet can
be. You're saying the only thing you object to in the bill is the ability to vape in your shop.
Yes. And I believe that's the Amendment-8, which we're asking for. And that's my major reason why. It kind of interrupts the entire process of helping people quit smoking and leaves them to just reading about it online.
That's real. Thank you.
Sure, we got a question. Yes. Let me ask a good question.
Of course.
Sorry, it's kind of a naive question, but the different flavors, do they also have a different, do they emit an odor to others around?
I'm really glad you asked that. Yeah. People walk into my shop and they'd say how nice it smells in here. Mm-hmm. They do emit an odor.
Okay.
Basically, the flavoring, we source from FDA-approved food flavoring companies. Some other companies will extract it themselves, but most of us get FDA-approved food flavorings that smell just like they taste. So this argument that you know, law enforcement is going to be confused about whether or not somebody's vaping a marijuana product or a flavored nicotine liquid is the same to me as, you know, can you taste the difference between ice cream and pot? And I'd also, you know, I mean, yes, of course you can. So you can smell the difference when they're vaporized.
Never tried ice cream.
No. And I'd also like to go so far as to say I'm all about helping people quit smoking. I don't want any association of smoking in my shop whatsoever. If I smell marijuana in there, they're going to get kicked out immediately. That's the opposite of my business.
Did you have a question?
My question is also sort of naive. Can you?
We're all naive in this area.
Naive in your area.
Just speak for myself. Can you regulate the amount of nicotine that you receive from the various vapors? So, for example, can I don't even know the terminology, so forgive me. Like, you know, choose a higher grade or a higher buzz or whatever word you want to use.
Well, I would stay away from the word buzz.
As you can tell, I'm not trying to get people of buzz.
You use concentration.
You know, we just legalized a whole substance that is, if you ask me, related to trying to get people a buzz. But I'm not trying to do that to people, yeah. Yes, it comes in usually increments of 6 or 4 milligrams of nicotine.
Okay.
Per batch. So usually you can get 0 nicotine, which is a goal to get the customers to, 6 milligram, 12 milligram, 18 milligram, 24 milligram. And then what I've found is, depending on how many packs a day somebody smokes, we can help them find the milligram level, because that sets their tolerance to the drug.
So it's both a flavor and a level of concentration. I'll try it that way.
Yeah, exactly. Like you could say, let's say we have tobacco flavor. It comes in 0 milligram, 6 milligram, 12 milligram, 18 milligram, 24 milligram. The same would be with all our other flavors. And that helps us find someone who smokes one cigarette a day is going to need much less nicotine than somebody who's been smoking 2 packs for the past, you know, 10 years. And the products are going to work for them or not, depending on if we put them in that right nicotine level. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name for the record is John Michaels. I'm with the EC Blend Company in Medford, and we employ about 130 employees down in the Medford area, and we manufacture the e-liquids. Now, I'm kind of new to some of this myself. I'm a non-smoker, and I don't vape, but I have seen how vaping has helped people dial down, get off cigarettes, and I've been very impressed. And I'm impressed as a former practical nurse. And I have a degree in health informatics. So I also look at evidence. And the evidence isn't out there from what I'm hearing. The evidence isn't out there yet to say one way or another. From a practical standpoint, you can have a cigarette with 1,000 chemicals, or you can have an e-cigarette with a flavoring, nicotine, and the propylene glycol is what they mostly use, is what they put in nebulizers. Common sense that says that's probably going to be the better choice. But I'd like to quickly, and I'll sum this up because I know you have to go, quickly say the argument I want to address is there's an argument out there that if we have all these flavors, it's going to entice children. Well, here's a memo. Kids are already smoking, sad to say. And so we don't sell to children. We, most industry, we do not sell to children, nobody under 18. That said, if they were to get a hold of this product, it would represent a much less harm than the cigarettes. And we already know they are getting a hold of cigarettes. And so the flavor issue to me is just a non-starter. And if that's the core of the argument, then I have a hard time with that. Yes, there are already cherry cigars and cigarettes and every flavor out there under the sun. So I hope that we keep this. I've heard too many great stories about people getting off cigarettes, and I'd hate to see that go away.
Do you support the bill?
I'd like, yes, with the amendment number 8, I think.
Shop amendment.
The vape shop amendment, yes. And like to see that put in there, because I've been in the shops when people are trying things out and they do want to try them out. That's what keeps them away from cigarettes and using the e-vape system. So,
thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for driving up.
He's got a number.
Or flying.
Yeah, she, he said.
Oh, sorry.
Could you call the next panel, please?
Jennifer Vines, John Ludlow, Carrie Nissen.
What is the position?
Jennifer Vines.
Dr. Burns, will you start us?
Great. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm Dr. Jennifer Vines. I'm the Deputy Health Officer.
Vines, I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's why I'm like, who's that?
You know that.
I'm the Deputy Health Officer of Multnomah County. I'm actually a family doctor by training, and I'm board certified in preventive medicine and public health. I've practiced public health and primary care in the Portland metro area for the last 10 years. I'm grateful to be here today. I have a very few PowerPoint slides that I want to go through with you today, and we're fortunate to have our County Board of Health also interested in this issue and really perceiving it as the urgent public health issue as it is, and they are considering a variety of local actions to protect our youth. So my key points today are very straightforward. I want to make sure you understand that nicotine itself has negative health effects. Nicotine is particularly dangerous for our young people, and including electronic cigarettes in the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act is a very important way not only to protect kids, but also to protect those adults who choose not to use these products. So again, nicotine itself is dangerous. People thought that it was just, you know, the thing that got you hooked to cigarettes, and then it was all the other bad things in cigarettes that harmed you. That is true. But nicotine itself is harmful, including accelerated heart and vascular disease. It's known to be associated with low birth weight and prematurity when used by pregnant women. And unfortunately, we now know that nicotine can be deadly because a one-year-old in New York died last December after ingesting liquid nicotine. So when people think about smoking, they think about heart disease and lung cancer, as they should. When we talk about nicotine in young people, though, we need to talk about the brain. And this is an image showing how three puffs there in the brain in the middle, how three puffs of nicotine quickly saturate the receptors in a young brain. So adolescents and young adults are particularly susceptible to the effects of nicotine because their brains are still developing. And we know that nicotine affects the areas of the brain that control intellect and the brain's reward pathways, which are implicated in addiction. Animal models cited in the Surgeon General's report on smoking suggest long-term structural changes that occur in the brains of youth exposed to nicotine, and several studies show an association between youth nicotine use and behavioral problems later in life like anxiety, depression, and substance abuse. So I find personally these images very shocking, and what you see here, of course, is legal and probably becoming more common. You can see that use of e-cigarettes among Oregon 11th graders almost tripled between 2011 and 2013. And again, public health is struggling to keep up with this exploding, unregulated industry, so I would guess that that number is probably higher by now. I've told you that young people are particularly at risk because of their brain, so they're more susceptible to the addictive effects of nicotine. They're also the targets of the billions of dollars spent in marketing of these products. We know that young people watch their peers and other adults around them to establish their norms for adult behavior. So the more they see people vaping and using e-cigarettes, I would argue the more likely they are to try them and get addicted themselves. Here's some images of what we're talking about. And I brought some examples today. So this is an example of an electronic cigarette here. This is meant to be disposable. So this is preloaded with nicotine. So I would inhale on this end and the nicotine would vaporize inside and I would inhale that and blow that out. So you can see why our law enforcement colleagues would not want to be having to figure out, you know, seeing me with this in my hand blowing a cloud of vapor, they wouldn't want to have to figure out if this was a cigarette or an electronic cigarette. This is called a vape pen, and this is what it looks like. It actually looks like a pen, and this is the mouthpiece, so I can take off the cap, and I can unscrew the mouthpiece, and I brought three examples of flavors, and I have my choice today of blowin' raspberries, blackberry cobbler, or Irish cream, and you know the nicotine content is on the label, which looks like it was printed on someone's home printer. The ingredients are listed, but I would have to take that all on faith because this industry is completely unregulated, so nobody really knows what's in that bottle. And then push the button, inhale, and vape. So you can see here some examples of other nicotine, or excuse me, vape pen and electronic cigarette designs. The photos on either side are actually from a Multnomah County tobacco retail assessment. So you can see the variety of flavors in the bottles there on the right. And on the left, it's a very busy photo, but the kind of the message here is that electronic cigarettes and all the things that go with it are just sort of mixed in, sitting out, you know, with the candy and other things for kids to help themselves to. And sadly, we know these nicotine products are making their way into the hands of our youngest children, and we know that poisonings associated, calls to poison control centers across the country have gone from 270 in 2011 to more than 3,000 last year, and many of those, half of those, are in children under age 6. So we know that the youngest children are getting their hands on these products. I have to say that a meaningful attempt to keep young people from purchasing these products must include a conversation about the tobacco retail environment and the fact that Oregon is one of only 11 states that does not require a license to sell tobacco. And this is an issue that's very close to our hearts in Multnomah County because we have one of the highest rates of illegal sales of cigarettes to minors in the country.
Dr. Vines, can we move you along?
Sorry? Yeah. Okay. So my last point is around speaking in support of including electronic cigarettes in the Indoor Clean Air Act. And this is around maintaining our social norms that prohibit tobacco and nicotine use in public setting. So electronic cigarette vapors are not just water vapor. The science is emerging that there are all kinds of things in it, and it's highly variable. So we know studies have shown varying levels of nicotine, carcinogens, volatile organic compounds, metals, and other chemicals. There is evidence that people can pass vape or be exposed secondhand to these products. And again, I would just urge you, in public health, you know, for decades with cigarettes, the burden was always on the public to prove harm. And this is a chance to really practice the precautionary principle where it matters and include these in the Indoor Clean Air Act. Stand up for our kids and for the people who choose not to use these products and don't care to be exposed to whatever might be in them. Thank you.
Thank you.
One real quick question.
Yeah, quick, please.
One of the numbers you just threw out for, you said children, the Poison Control Center for children that are 6 years old and under, that was up to 3,000, and that was over nicotine?
Those were calls to poison control centers where someone said, I think my kid just swallowed, you know, probably got their hands on this, which is not childproof, and I think they may have swallowed the contents.
Can we get a copy of that report by chance?
Yeah, I cited the website in my testimony, which I'll turn in.
Representative Bueller.
Quick question. Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it very much. How long do you think it would require the industry to prove that the vapor is either safe or harmful?
Well, so here's the problem. Because it's completely unregulated, you know, studies will pick up, you know, 10 or 20, you know, different types of liquid and test them and then report out on what they found in them. But those are 10 or 20 out of, say, 400 different products. So if you've tested one product, you've tested one product. So again, without regulation, it's going to be very hard to say exactly what they are. And then from there, what exactly is in them. And then from there, what are the health effects? But we do know that they are more than just water vapor.
I think we can have a methodological discussion on this. You can't. I mean, you could test one product or two products and find harm. You wouldn't have to go further. So, I mean, it's not an infinite number, but it's an interesting question. Let's move on, if that's right. Thank you, Dr. Vines. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich and committee members. My name is Carrie Neeson, and I serve as the Vice President for Advocacy for the American Lung Association of the Mountain Pacific, and I'm here to strongly support and urge your support for this bill. From the American Lung Association perspective, it's really all about our kids. And Oregon is just one of a handful of states where our youth can purchase products. They can go into a neighborhood store and they can buy their Hubba Bubba bubble gum. And along with that, they can buy their Juicy bubble gum e-juice, a product that contains nicotine. They can go into our neighborhood store and they can buy gummy bears. And right next to the gummy bears, they can buy Juicy Gummy Bear e-juice, again, a product that contains nicotine. They can go in and they can buy baby bottle pop, and a container right next to it can contain nicotine. It's candy, it's cotton candy flavored. It only makes sense that our youth can't purchase these kind of products. It just doesn't make sense. I'm very proud to live in a state where we can go into a restaurant and we no longer have to hear the choice smoking or non-smoking. I'm so jazzed that my nieces and nephews will never, ever have to hear that. Policies like that have decreased smoking rates. They've denormalized smoking. We don't smoke in airplanes anymore, not in restaurants, not in workplaces. Let's not take a step backwards and allow vaping in these places as well. We strongly support including e-cigarettes in our clean indoor air laws to protect our health. The emissions that come off of devices like this may not smell bad, but as Dr. Vine suggested, they do contain carcinogens, benzene, formaldehyde, nitrosamines, all sorts of things that can cause cancer in humans. There's clearly more than just water vapor in these products. Again, it's all about our kids. Let's keep these addictive products away from our kids, and let's keep our air clean. I strongly urge your support.
Thank you. Mr. Ludlow?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Ludlow. I'm chairman of the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity today to appear before you on behalf of a unanimous vote by the Clackamas County Commissioners to support HB 2546. I commend Representative Taylor for bringing this bill forward and congratulate her in becoming a newly elected member of the Clackamas County Legislative Delegation. As you're hearing today, Oregon is one of the few states that currently does not regulate the sale of e-cigarettes to minors. This is particularly concerning given that studies have found, as you've heard, there are dangerous chemicals in these, and it's unregulated. I was listening to OPB the other day, and a PSU professor explained that one of the delivery systems was formaldehyde, a carcinogen. The trends for our kids are alarming. Between 2011 and 2013, just 2 years, use of e-cigarettes among 11th graders has almost tripled from 1.8% to 5.2%. Nationally, almost 7% of youth between 6th and 12th grade reporting trying e-cigarettes. Just several weeks ago in Clackamas County, a high schooler was busted for using an e-cigarette to deliver some hash oil to him, and he was, of course, arrested. This shouldn't come as a surprise. E-cigarettes can be easily purchased over the Internet, as it was explained, in kiosks and almost every convenience store, and the multiple flavors like Peachy Keen, Chocolate Treat, target our youth much like candy in a candy store. This past September, Clackamas County banned the use of e-cigarettes in all of our county buildings. However, we deliberately held off any more rules enacting because we thought that it would be better that the state do that instead of the state being a patchwork quilt of different regulations for different municipalities. I ask for your support in passing HB 2546 by including e-cigarettes in the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act. The bill sends a clear message that vaping as well as smoking is not acceptable. Further, prohibiting sale to minors is the right thing to do for their health and well-being as our children. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today and, again, our support for this bill. Thank you
for coming over, Mr. Lazar. Let's get one more quick panel of folks who are opposing the bill so we can hear from them. Try and be fair. Will you call? Sure. Three more.
Leland Berger, Justin Rainey, Brian Hench.
Okay. For the rest of you, I really apologize that we're just running out of time on this one. We'll be back.
James Wright.
Okay, it's all right.
Yeah.
I'll sit in your lap.
But fast, please.
Yeah.
Chair James. Let's go.
We have 3 minutes before we need to leave the room.
Oh my.
You can take 2 minutes each. Let's go.
Just go. So, Chair Greenlick, my name's Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I've been practicing for 32 years. I've been coming to this legislature since 1999. I focus my practice for the last 20 years, on representing medical marijuana patients and their providers, and more recently on looking after the businesses as the emerging industry is coming into play. I speak in opposition of 3546 and ask that you delete the reference to cannabinoids. The fact is that vaporization is a safer delivery system for cannabinoids. It removes the carcinogenic, mutagenic properties of cannabis and is more healthful for patients. It assists in that fashion. Furthermore, prohibiting it under the Indoor Clean Air Act would prohibit the creation of lounges where people who are adults would be able to congregate under 91 and vaporize. And I think that the amendment that the Legislative Council spoke to about allowing the use, the therapeutic use in certain facilities that are licensed is insufficient to protect patients. So because it's problematic for patients, because it's problematic for the industry, and you know, if there were vapor lounges in Colorado, Maureen Dowd wouldn't have overdosed in her hotel room on chocolate. So nobody wants to harm children. However, there are children who are patients under the Medical Marijuana Act. I'm concerned that some of the reaches are overbroad as applied to the 50 Oregonians under age 18 who are patients as well. For these reasons, I ask you to delete the cannabinoid reference. I submitted electronically testimony, but I, from Cal Normal, had presented on some of the science and about a half an hour ago, and I'm not sure whether it got to you, but I'll follow up on that.
We'll make sure it's in. Well, you can check it yourself.
Thank you so much, sir.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Justin Rainey. I'm here today on behalf of Reynolds America. Reynolds America is the second largest manufacturer of cigarettes in the United States, and they own RJR Vapor Company, which manufactures the vapor product Vuse. I'm going to be quick because I've talked with some of you before, but I want to highlight or put on the record that Reynolds supports the provisions of the bill that would ban the sale of electronic cigarettes to minors. We also would support violations against retailers who sell to minors or minors who are found to have this in possession. We've been working with Representative Olson on a bill that we believe does that. So we're strongly supportive of youth tobacco prevention efforts. I want to highlight a couple other quick things relating to the bill. We support efforts for child-resistant packaging. We think some of the comments made with children drinking the liquid should be addressed. But we do want to work with the committee on an exemption for products that are already tamper-proof or resistant. We manufacture the product Vuse, and that's a closed system that's not designed to be opened or you can't access the liquid. So we'd ask the committee to consider language that's similar to what Illinois and Vermont adopted and what the state of Washington's currently considered. We do have a couple concerns with some rulemaking authority that's been granted to the Oregon Health Authority for labeling. We think that this is something that the FDA should handle just as they do cigarettes. They handle the labeling of that. The legislation also addresses issues where they talk about packaging that is attractive to minors. We have concerns that this bill could prompt legal challenges based on an infringement of commercial free speech. We don't know what would be considered attractive to minors or not, but there have been cases dealing with packaging of traditional cigarettes that have ended up in the court over this matter. So we'd like the committee to take some time to talk through that issue. We strongly believe that making sure that the product is behind counters and where you have age verification is the best way to keep this product out of the hands of minors. That's how we sell our product. In closing, I won't spend too much time on the study because you're going to hear from others about cessation. We've provided several different studies that talk about addictions, as well as some conclusions from the American Heart Association for you to review. And in closing, I do just want to point out that a traditional cigarette has 7,000 chemicals with over 250 known carcinogen, 69, which we know to be particularly damaging. E-cigarettes don't burn tobacco. They consist of five ingredients, essentially. So they're very different products. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. My name's Brian Hinch. I'm a Salem resident and a part owner of a vape shop here in Oregon, in Kaiser, actually. And, excuse me. Of course, I'm nervous, but that's okay.
Thank you for coming. You're doing fine.
That's okay. So I have COPD and emphysema. And one of the reasons that we started the vape shop, one of the reasons why I invested my own money in it, is because I saw it as an opportunity to help people quit smoking before they got to my kind of condition. Now, I did quit smoking in 1986. My wife and I both made a pact, and we quit together on the same day, and I've never smoked a cigarette since. However, that didn't keep me from getting emphysema and COPD, and that explains my shortness of breath and the problems that I have. Now, if you were to light up a cigarette in this room right now, I would have to leave. I couldn't stay in this room because my lungs would shut down. I'd be hitting my inhaler as I walked out the door and coughing all the way home. And that's the problem with cigarettes. And I agree that cigarettes are a very dangerous and addictive substance. On the other hand, if every one of you lit up a vape, if you had a vape pen in your hand, if you were using it in front of me and filling this room with vapor from vape pens, I could sit here and I would be just as comfortable as I am at this moment. I see there's a real problem with the way that vaping is being viewed, and especially by this bill that's before you, in that they're trying to make vaping painted with the same brush of disgust as smoking is. And I don't see them as the same thing. I see them as two very different things that appear similar. So, as an example, and I brought these along because almost all of you are familiar with little green candies. And so I have three little bags of green candies. And you can see they're all green. They're all very, very similar. But this one will kill children. This one is ferrous glutenate. Ferrous glutenate, I have to take it because I'm anemic. It may have something to do with my former smoking, I'm not sure. But this white here, if I gave it to a 3-year-old child or a 12-year-old child, if they took all of these pills, they would die from iron toxicity. Now, these two, you're welcome to them. One is M&M's and one is Skittles. From here, where you're sitting, it's very difficult to tell which one's which. And this is the problem with this law. It's so broad, and it strikes so many places, that it virtually eliminates the idea of vaping, which could prove to be a health boon. And at the same time, it's not really touching the things that need to be touched. I am in total agreement with the gentleman here, the nurses, and the rest of them who want to eliminate the possibility of children under 18 picking up the vaping habit. When we have customers come into the shop, we go through the same process that the other gentleman who was seated here went through in order to get people into a place where they can successfully cease smoking.
Can you wrap up?
I'm not going to wrap it up. So,
doing great.
Thanks. Still a little nervous. So far, there is no real scientific proof that this is either good or bad or indifferent. So I say let's keep those 18-year-old or under 18-year-old people away from it. Let's make it so they don't come. I already have signs posted in my shop. They were there from the day we opened. We don't sell to people who are under 18. We card them if they look like they're under 21. We do provide free samples for people to try, not to take home, but they're all zero nicotine. We have over 40 flavors, but they're all based on the same kinds of things that you use in pastries, cakes, and candies. The problem that I see is that this is a really overzealous attempt to try to stop something before it gets started, and that you're basically stamping the ants on top of the anthill, but you're never going to get to the queen because the internet will overcome everything that we attempt to do unless we make something that actually works. And I think that vaping should be regulated in its own right and that it should be licensed and controlled in a way that protects children but allows us the freedom to continue to operate our businesses and continue to help people who are smoking quit. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
For the record, my name is James Wright. I am a lab personnel at Vape Right, the store that Mr. Hinch partially owns. I create liquids in our shop for our customers. I do this in a very scientific manner. I've been trained in the medical profession. I'm also have a degree in health informatics. We use computer programs to measure out exactly what ingredients go into the liquid. We use vegetable glycine, propylene glycol, nicotine, in either a 100% vegetable glycine mix or a 50-50 propylene glycol vegetable glycine mix. This is all done in a clean room environment. We have air filtration down to 1 micron. We wear lab coats and gloves and masks and everything to protect our customers. Just to kind of walk you through how we make it. I mean, do you have any questions on it, or I mean?
Thank you for being here.
Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
If I could just ask him if everybody could get a chance to look at the -9 and -8 amendments that I have, and just get with my office and
I do agree with the -8 amendment to the proposed bill, because we do test them in our shop. So if that's not there, then they can't use or test them.
Are you putting the -8s into the OLIS? We haven't gotten them as a committee yet.
Yeah, I'll get them entered in OLIS. I just got them back today. Mark worked on them this weekend for me.
And only I can put it in OLIS.
Yeah, if you give it to Sandy, she'll get
it up on OLIS.
You get them to her, she'll get it up.
I will get them to Sandy.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you guys very
Thank
much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
And again, I apologize to you who are here hoping to testify. We've run out of time. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2546 and adjourn the committee. 6.